Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. Today, I saw that there was an excerpt from Charles Spencer's new book, A Very Private School. Obviously, Charles Spencer is Princess Diana's brother. And he revealed he lost his virginity to a prostitute on a family vacation when he was 12 years old. Said that he was on a trip to Italy with his mother and stepfather when he spotted a short-skirted sex worker standing on a corner. So he used his pocket money to pay the woman about 20 bucks. Okay. That is craziness. And what about the mom and the stepdad? They, oh, sure. Go ahead. You're 12 years old. Why not pick up a hooker from the corner? But I wanted to talk. It got me to thinking, I haven't really ever talked about Charles Spencer. Obviously, we've talked about Diana a little bit. And Spencer became engaged to model Victoria a scant 6 weeks after meeting her. And they were married in 1989 with Prince Harry as a page boy and businessman Darius Guppy serving as best man. Victoria Lockwood. Guppy was eventually jailed in 1993 for staging a faked jewel robbery and claiming £18 million from insurers. And that's a story that I had forgotten. But Guppy and his close friend Ben Marsh decided to start dealing in gems by buying precious stones firstly in Colombia, smuggling them into Britain, and selling them for a profit in Hatton Garden in London. And they made $6,000 on the first trip, excluding expenses. And while this is going on, you know, on the weekends he's out shooting with Charles Spencer and others. They're shooting duck and pheasant. And then Guppy and Marsh decided to go into buying gold bars in London and smuggling them into Mumbai. And they used a guy named Ishan Dutty, an investment banker in Mumbai and later in the city of London. And he would handle the smuggled gold bars upon their arrival in the docks in Mumbai. And then later, Guppy hired a man named William Hall, a professional bully, along with six other guys, to threaten an Indian dealer named Guti, who owed Guppy and Marsh £250,000. And Guppy rang Guti in India and told him he would have him gutted like a rabbit unless he returned the money. And Guti found the money when Hall and those other guys arrived on his front doorstep. Then Guppy and Ben Marsh said, you know, we're still not making enough here. We'd like to make even more money. Let's become like just full-on criminals. So the two men flew to New York on the Concorde and booked into the Halloran Hotel in the city. And then they arranged a prearranged robbery in their hotel room of gems valued at about $3 million. They hired this guy named Peter Risden for $10,000 plus expenses to hold them up in their hotel room at gunpoint, fire a bullet into the bed, tie them up, and flee with the quote-unquote jewels. Well, apparently Guppy and Marsh were very good actors, and they fooled the New York Police Department. Also conned was Lloyd's Bank, and gave them a check on April 12, 1990 for the value of gems, which is worth, in today's dollars, about $6 million. And the two of them divided it between them. Meanwhile, they had flown back to New York to pick up the gems that they had claimed were stolen. And it was basically only greed that brought down Guppy. And he and Marsh were supposedly going to be jailed for 5 years in 1993. Because what had happened was Risden and Duddy and William Hall turned informers to get off prison sentences. And Risden had found out that, okay, I'm getting paid $10,000. And you guys made millions of dollars. And so that's why if they had given him more money, he probably wouldn't have ever turned him in. And when he jailed Guppy, the judge also fined him about £500,000 for a conspiracy to steal. And later it was changed to a compensation order, which means if you just pay the money, then you can get out of jail. And Marsh handed over money, like he took it from his share, but Guppy didn't. But the judge said, hey, I believe Guppy still has access to ill-gotten gains, even though Guppy said, I don't have any. And the judge said, I take a clear view, you should not profit from your acts. But what happened was Guppy appealed, and Lloyd said, okay, fine. You can just pay us £156,000. And somehow, even though he had declared himself bankrupt, Guppy somehow managed to find the $156,000 to give to Lloyd's. So he got out of jail in 1994, late at night, and he reunited with his wife, Patricia, and 2-year-old daughter, Isabella. And Patricia had been actually pregnant when her husband was convicted. But we really didn't hear a lot more about Guppy until 2006. And the only reason we heard about him in 2006 is because he got into a huge fight with Charles Spencer. And as newspaper accounts described it at the time, they said, smeared with blood and sweat, the two men grappled and thrashed around. The taller man groaned in pain from a fractured cheekbone and injuries to his ribs and nose as his attacker savagely kicked and punched him like someone possessed. As the violence escalated, 3 young children watched and cheered their father from the windows of their home. The son and 3 daughters of the other man could only look on in dumb horror as their father was battered into submission. It was an extraordinary and shocking scene, but all the more shocking given the identities of the combatants. This bloody confrontation was between Charles Spencer and his best friend, Darius Guppy. Guppy, who emerged the victor from the brawl, had deliberately lured his former friend, who had been his best man, by the way, to the wedding of Patricia. And also, Charles had given him $250,000 bail after his arrest. But apparently, at stake was the honor of the wife that Guppy adored, even though later on we'll talk about the fact that he pretty much beat her throughout their entire marriage. But Spencer's crime, and Spencer denied it, was to have attempted to seduce Guppy's wife, Patricia, while Guppy was in jail. Now, Guppy and Charles Spencer had known each other since they were 13 years old. And apparently, he wanted to get even. But everybody's like, okay, well, where has Guppy been? He only served a couple years in jail. And he said he wanted to start a new life with his family first in Ireland. And Charles Spencer gave him the money to buy the house in Ireland, which he later sold for a profit. And then came to South Africa. So the question was in 2006, how does he make money? How does he live? He had a mansion with a swimming pool, international travel, would take these shark diving excursions with friends, but he had no bank account in South Africa, no property or business under his name, no registration with the tax authorities. He had kept a low profile. And like I said, he was married to Patricia. She was a former factory worker turned model, and the home that they lived in 2006 was actually bought in 2004, but under his wife's name for about £500,000. It's a big house, sat at the top of a steep drive. It was obscured from view by trees and bushes. Now, it was much smaller than the other houses that surrounded them, but it did have, tennis courts and a swimming pool. And Guppy's neighbors included diplomats and rich businessmen, families who had owned land in the area for generations. But locals spoke of him in 2006 as a rather menacing, egotistical man with an interest in martial arts and extreme pastimes such as diving with sharks. And he and Patricia at the time preferred to socialize with a small and close circle of British expats, including Charles Spencer's ex-wife, Victoria, who at the time had a new husband, Jonathan, who was a former Dior male model. They had met in rehab, and we'll get to that. Until the fight, Charles Spencer hung out in those same circles with Guppy. And his house was about 200 yards from the Guppies and also close to the house that was sold by Mark Thatcher. So, everybody was there. It's just this very, very exclusive kind of suburb. There's a lot of joggers, including Patricia, locals walking their dogs. And Patricia was a very familiar figure at the Village Shopping Center. She was a regular at the Carlton Skincare Center, where all the Rich housewives went for facials. She belonged to a gym and a tennis club. And the children were educated at private schools. And it was just like, how are they affording all this? Because he left prison apparently penniless. He and Ben Marsh were estimated to have made around a total of, let's say, £4 million from the crime. And they had to pay $500,000 each at the time of their conviction. And Marsh paid up the full amount. But remember, Guppy appealed and everything. And he said that his share of the money had been spent or given to a mysterious businessman named Mr. X, not our Mr. X. So then his fine was reduced. But then he declared himself bankrupt so he wouldn't have to pay the cash. But the judge said, nope, you're going to have to stay in there until you come up with the money. Now, when he got out of jail, he made about £100,000 selling his life story in a newspaper and then set up a couple of import and export companies in Ireland, but they never seemed to do any business. And he also marketed himself on the after-dinner speech circuit with Marsh, and his promo literature said incredible stories of a James Bond lifestyle, including Uzi submachine guns and crooks singing like canaries to the NYPD. According to documents in South Africa, he was a property investor. Like I said, he made a profit from the Irish house. But no money from that seems to have been invested anywhere. And everything was registered in Patricia Guppy's name. Sounds very mob-like. Guppy was not listed as a director of any company in South Africa. He didn't own any property in the country. And his business certainly involved travel. And like I said, this is 2006. Later on, we get a little bit of a better idea of why he was traveling. But one neighbor said he's never there. He's away 2 weeks a month. It's always Patricia holding the fort. But they said Guppy was familiar to regulars on the overnight flight from Johannesburg to Paris. He had been seen in London and Amsterdam. And because he was spending over 6 months out of South Africa, he didn't have to pay any income tax. And at the time, Patricia said, oh, our marriage is great. They had just celebrated their 15th wedding anniversary. They went to Turkey for 3 weeks. But they had this huge fight, right? He had this huge fight with Charles Spencer. And at the time, everybody said, well, Patricia's kind of freaked out by exposure. Her big concern is the kids. And he had in his autobiography, Guppy had used a quotation. And at the beginning, it said, revenge is kind of wild justice, which the more man's nature runs to it, the more ought to law to weed it out. And that's from Sir Francis Bacon. And then 2011, we have Guppy, again, living in South Africa, still with Patricia and their three kids. But now we found out that he spends much of his time on business in Iran, where his mom was born. His grandfather on his maternal side was an Ayatollah, but not a mullah. But he was asked about his business, and he said, I'm a globe-trotting man of international mystery. Are you an arms dealer? I'm not an arms dealer. I trade with the Middle East with a particular focus on Iran, buying and selling things. Like what? Well, put it this way. If we were go to war with Iran, I would be in trouble. But I know which side I would be on. But why did he want to beat up Charles Spencer? Patricia Guppy, right? She's from Sunderland. She once ran an escort agency. And she supposedly kept this incident that got Guppy so mad for more than a decade because she didn't want to upset her husband. Apparently, it happened when her husband was just starting his jail sentence and she was living on Charles Spencer's estate in Althorp. And basically, his sister Dinah's request for permission to reside in the garden house at Althorp, the Earl instead offered the house to Patricia and her toddler daughter. And friends of Guppy claimed that while she was there, and later for a face-to-face meeting came a month later when Spencer was due to visit Cape Town, basically, they had maybe hooked up. So Guppy finds out about it. He comes back from a European business trip. And he calls Charles Spencer on his mobile phone. Said, okay, I believe your story that you didn't try and hook up with my wife, but I want to hear it from you in person. And, okay, Spencer goes, okay, but I want to meet you in a public place. But Guppy convinced him it would be better to keep it private and assured him he would be safe at his house. And Patricia Guppy was out of town. She was away at a spa. And Spencer goes over to Darius's house. And Darius asked his friend for an explanation. And Charles Spencer said, I never made any advances on Patricia. And Guppy accused him of lying and then started punching him and kicking him in the lawn in front of his children. And they were cheering. And Spencer had cuts to his nose, a black eye, concussion, a fractured cheekbone. And it ended only when Charles Spencer's ex-wife Victoria's husband, who also lived in the area, climbed over the gates to the Guppy house after hearing the fight. And he was accompanied by Charles Spencer's four children from her first marriage. And Jonathan Aitken, not the former Tory MP, who also has a very interesting story. And it's hard to believe that there's two people with interesting stories with the same name like that. But Aitken pulled Guppy off and took Charles Spencer home. And then 2 days later, Guppy wrote Spencer accusing him again of sexually harassing his wife. And then basically friends of Guppy let journalists kind of know what happened and said, hey, here's Guppy's letter to Spencer. But when they were growing up, I mean, they were inseparable. They were each other's best man. And like I said, Spencer housed Guppy and his family when Guppy was released from prison. I mean, that's kind of the thing. Now, remember, I said earlier that Patricia possibly was an escort. She got married when she was 18. She got divorced 2 years later. And she worked as a presser in a clothing factory where she told a colleague she felt there must be more to life than a dead-end job. So she moves to London in 1989, met Guppy at a club in Soho called Groucho's. And while he was awaiting trial, she was mixing with Zoe Bowman, who was running an escort agency. And Bowman charged clients up to basically £1,000 a night for high-class hookers, and her agency was called Diplomat. And Bowman said Patricia knew about the business, but didn't work as a prostitute herself, but would hand-pick girls and fix up appointments. Okay. And the London Madam had been a guest at Patricia's wedding to Guppy in July 1991. And Zoe's daughter was a bridesmaid. And our madam rubbed shoulders with Princess Diana, Charles Spencer, Victoria at the wedding. She said later, I chatted to all the guests and found them charming, especially Earl Spencer and his wife, who, of course, had no idea what I did for a living. Well, I wanted to find out about Zoe Bowman. I could not find anything because I wanted to know what happened, if there's any scandals. Well, it turns out her name was actually Zoe Payne. And in 2003, somebody caught up to her and they wrote about it. They said she was the high society vice princess who led a champagne lifestyle and mingled with royalty. Blonde Zoe Payne's Little Red Book was like a directory of the British aristocracy and provided the rich and famous with high class hookers. She counted Princess Diana's brother, Earl Spencer, as a friend and rubbed shoulders with criminal Darius Guppy. But ex-society Madam Payne's existence is now a million miles away from that of her powerful and flamboyant friends. The mom is now broke and living on benefits in a Glasgow housing scheme. The designer label clothes have been swapped for a worn t-shirt, jeans, and sneakers. Her new home is an apartment that basically was free government subsidized. Instead of the $750,000 home she had before. But she ran the Diplomat escort agency in London in the 90s, was the boss of dozens of prostitutes. Her agency was a favorite with the jet set. Her girls charged, like I said, £1,000 a night for the services. And her prostitutes would accompany the wealthy clients on foreign sex and drug trips. And she made thousands upon thousands of pounds each week from this prostitution empire. She was also friendly with, why is it that every story that we have ever done on the podcast talking about hookers somehow always involves Adnan Khashoggi? But he was one of her biggest clients and liked her to call him honey. She once boasted that one of her clients was a world leader from the Middle East, but the lifestyle collapsed and she was living on £53 a week. She said that she was writing a book about her sex exploits and was looking for a publisher. I can't find it if it ever happened. But Zoe's agency was the most popular in London, and diplomats' clients wanted a certain type of girls. The girls were educated, and many had their own professional careers away from being call girls. That's why I think maybe Patricia Guppy was. It's easy to see why so many men in powerful positions would use Zoe. But it's changed for her now. She doesn't have a job, scrapes by on benefits. It's hard to believe she used to keep company with Earl Spencer and other rich and famous people. She got on well with them and didn't look out of place. And they also said that Zoe was never a prostitute and was motivated purely by making money out of running the business. And like I said, she spent time writing a book about her life. Adnan called her all the time. And very, very interesting that it all went away. And what's the thing that happened? I think also in 1991, at the same time you have Patricia and Guppy getting married, and then, you know, he's stealing the money and all that. At the same time, one of Zoe's escorts was murdered. A woman by the name of Sharon Hoare, not spelled that way, H-O-A-R-E. She was 19, and she was found strangled in a London flat in 1991. Well, later on, there was a big investigation into the Camden Ripper, a guy named Anthony Hardy. And nobody can ever prove it, but they think that he was the one who murdered Sharon. There was a program, Channel 5 in the UK, Killers Behind Bars. And one of the hosts had spent, a professor had spent a lot of time zeroing in on the case of Sharon. And she had come to London from Bristol with a dream of becoming a model, but had turned to prostitution. And this professor interviewed Sharon's dad. And it was the first time he had spoken about the unsolved case. And he said that he was anonymously tipped off that his daughter had been knelt on during her death. And that's basically what this professor had determined, that Anthony Hardy, the Camden Ripper, was his M.O. He called it a crush. And, you know, the dad of Sharon, who was like crying during the interview, said, "I had an email to say, I think the minicab driver should be investigated." And he said, "I thought that was quite odd at the time." And what they found out was that Hardy was actually working as a minicab driver at the time of Sharon's death. And a woman who knew both Hardy and another person reveals that she got to know him after he picked her up in his cab from a nightclub. And the dad of Sharon said, "You know, I'd love closure. It'd be nice to see someone punished because this isn't right. There's a man or woman walking around, perhaps having a good life, that can't be right." And then this professor found a forgotten, like, sketch thing that the police had done, like an identikit. And it was briefly printed in newspapers in the 1990s, around the time of Sharon's death, of a suspect believed to have attacked prostitutes in West London. And there's a clear resemblance to Hardy, you know. And the professor said the revelation that Hardy worked as a minicab driver and the fact that Sharon was last sighted in one before her murder, although circumstantial, are a significant lead. His similarity to the identikit of a man attacking sex workers in West London feels important, too. It makes me believe there are enough compelling leads to warrant further investigation by police in both these cases. But the Metropolitan Police said the possibility that Anthony Hardy was responsible for other murders was fully investigated at the time, and no evidence to support this was uncovered, and so there's not going to be any further action by police. Interesting. And Patricia, going back to her, she, gave birth. She was pregnant at the time of the trial, but she was pregnant with twins, but she lost one of the twins, and she said it was because of the stress. And, you know, Charles Spencer helped them out. I mean, this is the crazy thing. And he promised to look after Patricia and the baby while his friend was in jail. And it's also said that Guppy was totally infatuated and totally in love with Princess Diana. You know, that's kind of crazy. But going back to Charles, like I said at the very beginning, 6 weeks after meeting Victoria Lockwood, they got engaged. The pair were married at a service attended by Diana and Prince Charles. Prince Harry, like I said, was a page boy. And if you look at what Victoria wore, like her gown, it's medieval style, and it still would be kind of in fashion today. And she had the Spencer tiara. So they had four children, Lady Kitty, who we definitely get to in a different episode. And then twins, Lady Amelia and Lady Eliza. They had a son. And they moved from Althorp to South Africa because they wanted to give their children more privacy. And one of the kids, Eliza, has said, you know, the plan seemed to work. We were so lucky to have a normal, relaxed childhood. Public scrutiny didn't exist at all. But at the time that they moved, reports were beginning to emerge of Charles Spencer's infidelities. So I am going to take you behind the scenes of the trial of his first divorce. His second one is just about as bad. But his first divorce to Victoria. So we have to go back in time to November 27th, 1997. Love cheat Earl Spencer barred his wife from Princess Diana's funeral by refusing to pay her airfare. But he did come up with the money to take his 33-year-old mistress, Calvin Klein model Josie Borraine. And these allegations were made by Victoria, who also claimed she lived in fear of his drunken rages. Affidavits from Victoria on the third day of their bitter divorce hearing in South Africa say her husband refused to pay the £2,000 airfare so she could go to the funeral. And Victoria said she was concerned at comments she dithered over whether to attend the funeral. In fact, she claimed Spencer insisted she stay and look after the kids. And she said, you know, during this trial that she was really having a tough time taking care of the kids and paying all the bills. And even though we're in 1997, late 1997, she said the marriage finally ended one evening in about August of 1994. She said she was lying in the bath when he told her the marriage was over and he didn't love her anymore. And then she wanted about £3.75 million and £5,000 a month in child support for each of the kids. But Spencer was like, I can only afford to give her £300,000. Because I only make about $1 million a year. But one of the things that he did in court was he got an order where it wasn't supposed to be talked about publicly, at least in South Africa, for the sake of his little girl, Kitty, who, I, like I said, we will talk about later. But the Earl in this court hearing said that the divorce was the talk of six-year-old Kitty's school, thanks to reports in South African papers, and he's claimed newspaper posters about Spencer's other women were tied to lampposts on her route to school. So Spencer won a gag order to stop two Cape Town newspapers talking about the divorce battle. As he said, I asked Kitty last weekend whether she knew what was happening between Victoria and me, and she said she knew we were in the process of divorcing because all her friends at school were talking about it. And I should mention that Kitty's able to read posters referring to the other women. So these newspapers had to stop reporting it. I guess under South African law, you're not supposed to publish details of divorce hearings. But the newspapers were challenging the law, saying, hey, he deliberately made himself a public figure. But the judge came down on Spencer's side. But it didn't mean that the rest of the tabloids in the world weren't talking about it. November 30th, 1997. Earl Spencer's angry speech at Princess Diana's funeral, because remember, she's also died in 1997, won many friends. His words of love for his sister and royal nephews struck a chord with the nation. But today, the Earl's reputation for decency lies in tatters. Regardless of the outcome of his bitter divorce battle, the world now knows him as a philanderer who admitted in a letter he was both callous and vicious to his sick wife. For the man known as Champagne Charlie, it has been one of the worst weeks of his life. So, the hearing opened, I mean, just, Victoria's lawyer told the court that the Earl had bedded between 10 and 12 women in 5 months while his wife was at rehab. Victoria showed up to court with one of the former mistresses, a divorcee named Chantel Colopy. And the two were put on a show of unity. And I mean, that's some crazy stuff right there. And Victoria said, hey, I did start using drugs while I was working in New York in the 1980s. She became hooked on hard drugs while in Indonesia in 1988. That's where eating disorders also begin. But the Earl was said to have made cruel jokes at her expense. He told friends at a birthday party that his father told him to stick with his wife through thick and thin, and that Victoria was thin and certainly thick. Now, at the beginning of that day, you know, he was smiling and relaxed and grinning and chatting. But then as the day went on, I mean, he just was like looking rough. And we also had the contents of a love letter written by Spencer to Chantel. In it, the Earl called his wife immature, said she's incapable of dealing with a husband except by going on a hunger strike, an alcohol binge, or resorting to drugs. And that he had tried to force Victoria out of his life, called his marriage a terrible error. And the letter was written in 1995, 7 months after he started his fling with Chantel. And he told Chantel, to be loved by you is the greatest gift I could ask for. And basically, he had claimed that he had behaved very well to his wife. And so then this came. And then the Earl's legal team said that if Victoria was given that much money, she would be unable to manage it because of her drug addiction. And Chantel talked about how he got her into bed, broke up with her with a phone call. And he had to explain to the court, yeah, you know, my family fortune's estimated at $100 million, but my personal fortune's just about $6 million. And that most of his wealth was tied up in Althorp, the Spencer home, and in trusts. And in South Africa, he owned only two homes, two trucks, and a Mercedes. Oh. And one of Victoria's lawyers says, it's surprisingly common that when a divorce court approaches, a husband's businesses go down. And just basically, the Earl's lawyers said that Victoria and Chantel were greedy liars. I was just so horrible. And Victoria had written letters to the Earl from her rehab thanking him for his tolerance and support. And Spencer's lawyer said, hey, I would never treat the mom of, you know, the four kids in a mean or malicious manner. And he also said, again, this is Spencer's lawyer, that Chantel was determined to become the next Countess Spencer at any price, even abandoning her own children in South Africa. And Spencer kind of knew that Victoria was going to go this way and tried to make her a huge financial offer to head off the revelations, but it wasn't enough. So they went to court and all this stuff came out. And there was also an argument about whether it should take place in England or South Africa, the divorce stuff. And you think that it was probably as bad as it could be, but it wasn't. Because December 1st, 1997, Chantel was about to go on the stand. And she said their affair ended when he told her he could never accept her two children in the relationship. The couple had planned to marry, but he got cold feet at the last minute after her own marriage had broken down. And she said that she had decided to help Victoria after the Earl made comments about her weight. The affair had begun while Lady Spencer was receiving treatment for drugs and an eating disorder. And Chantel said, I was devastated by the fact that my family was now broken. I was now divorced with no one. I suddenly started feeling very insecure about the way I looked and started worrying about my weight because he had mentioned to me that I should not get fat. I know what she has gone through. But the case settled before Chantel could testify. And Victoria got basically what she had wanted. At the same time that all this is going on, Chantel's husband is suing Charles Spencer for alienation of affection. On February 22nd, 1998, Spencer struck a secret deal with the cheated husband of his former mistress to stop her revealing intimate details of their affair in court. Earl of Spencer had tried to do a counterclaim for invasion of privacy against Chantel's husband, Don. And then Don also halted his actions because he had been publicly humiliated in the alienation of affection. And both cases were going to be heard, and they were going to be even more explosive than the divorce hearing. But Don said, I can confirm the matter between Earl Spencer and myself has been settled. I cannot divulge details because of a confidentiality agreement. But Chantel said, you know, I was prepared to take the stand for Don and give whatever evidence was necessary. No matter what has happened between us, Don is still the father of my two children. I cannot stand by and see him being taken to court without helping him. I asked Charles some time ago to drop his action, but he refused. I made it clear to him that whatever he did to Don, he was doing to me, and I would not stand by and do nothing. And, you know, basically Don was the one who was wronged, and he was outraged when Spencer sued him. And Don had just lost his wife and family. He's broken up. He was determined to go all the way. But Charles Spencer knew that Chantel was going to talk about all kinds of stuff. But it had never happened in the divorce case because it was settled like the day before she could give evidence. And Don was also prepared to subpoena Victoria Spencer to give evidence against her ex-husband. So, I mean, it was crazy. And it had dated back to July of 1996 when Don had accused the Earl of stealing his wife. And he revealed that he had secretly tape-recorded her phone calls to Spencer and planned to use them as evidence in a divorce action. So, I mean, whew. I mean, that was crazy. And even more crazy was that was February 1998. In December 1998, Chantel said that she was getting back together with Don. Don and I haven't set a date yet, but we'll definitely be getting married in the new year. But she had no regrets about her two-year affair with Earl, which wrecked her marriage. She said, Don gets so angry when I say this, but I can't lie. I do not have any regrets about my relationship with Charles. Don and I have both learned so much. In retrospect, it was the best thing that could have happened to us. Both of us have grown so much because of it. What I do regret is hurting Don. He's actually been incredible throughout this time, and I realize that I love him dearly. And Don said, Chantel and I were always meant to be together. But for a while, we both lost sight of that fact. And Chantel and her sons had quit, left the house that Earl Spencer had bought for her, and moved into Don's rented home. She said, the boys are so happy to have their parents together again. They missed their dad terribly, and it's great to live like a normal family again. And, you know, before Chantel moved back in with Don, they tried it all out. Don said, we wanted to be sure it worked this time. You don't have an Earl cause a rift the size between you and your wife and get over it overnight. We had to rebuild our trust, and that took time. I have forgiven Chantel for what happened, but I'll never forgive Spencer. And Chantel had first met Earl Spencer at a 40th birthday party for a cricketer in July 1994. And remember, August 1994 is what Victoria had said was the end of their marriage. And Don said, I didn't see how well Spencer and my wife were getting along. I didn't become suspicious until a long time afterwards when I began noticing how much she was talking about him. And that the romance, you know, quickened when the Earl moved to Cape Town with Victoria. And then Don learned about it, bugged his wife's bedside phone. In one tape, Spencer had told Chantel, I know I love you. I've done my looking around and I know how I need and want you. And Don said, I was unbelievably hurt. It's one thing to suspect your wife's having an affair, but deep down you hope it's your imagination. But he made the tapes public. You know? And that was just... And when Spencer told her it was over, she called Don. I was in tears, and Don was so reassuring and sweet. He asked me to look after myself and come back to South Africa. He never trusted Charles. He wanted to warn me that as soon as our affair became public, he would drop me like a hot potato. I suppose in the end, he was proved right. True. I mean, but Chantel also blamed Don for the breakup, too. She said, Don never gave me flowers or offered to make a cup of tea or clear away the table after dinner. Those little things had fallen by the wayside. You know? And Don said, it's like the old saying, you don't know what you got until it's gone. Chantel said, we don't take each other for granted anymore. Don has learned that he needs to be aware of other people's needs, and I am much, much wiser. In the next episode, we are going to talk about Spencer's marriage number two and that divorce. We're going to talk about Victoria and her second marriage and that crazy divorce. It's just never ending. But for right now, it is. I'll talk to you guys next.